You are listening to Radio Albion.
Listening to yet another edition of the Orthodox Nationalist. I am Matthew Raphael Johnson, and we're in the middle of June 14th, 2023. I think the fallout of Sven's prison sentence still hasn't, I'm happy it hasn't seemed to have worn off. There's nothing normal about this. There's nothing normal about those with power. But just as, you know, Ukraine is using terror because they're losing, the regime uses terror against its own people because it's losing. Its economy is not long for this world. So, as always, I appeal to you to contact Sven at the Swansea prison in Wales. Everything, that's all online. And to donate either to him directly or to me. As I said, I'm getting a fixed amount to him every month. And really is, it's this North Korean-style repression. And, you know, since everyone is being brought under surveillance, so-called connection with terrorism and keywords, and, you know, this is completely dystopian. But it is one of the biggest issues today. And one of the things, apparently, you can get in trouble for, actually be banned, is supporting the Russian Federation in the present war. Now, I know I've hit this topic many, many, many times, but it kind of makes sense that I would be one of the main guys laying out the data and the arguments and its connection to the decline of the West. And I want to do something else. The last couple of weeks, I have rewritten and gone over and added material to much older either articles or lectures. If you go back to 2009, one of my the first few lectures of any kind back then, the voice of reason, were on Ukraine, specifically the decline of what used to be the center of the Soviet Union, at least in terms of electronics and agriculture and so much else, is now a fourth world, disastrous, depopulated country. And I want to talk about now and bring some of this stuff up to date, because this is the sort of thing that the State Department, journalists, military men have no idea. I have a tremendous influence over the course of events in Eastern Europe. And it's all based on the error that they're just poorer versions of Americans and Westerners, and that their one desire more than anything else is to become good liberals and capitalists. And take out loans to buy homes. And that's always been the Whig conception of history. And it's rarely, if ever, true. Now, I wrote an article, and then later I rewrote it as a lecture, and then I rewrote it several times since then. And I guess the working title has been Theoretical Views on Ukrainian Nationalism, Socialism, and Capitalism Since the Dissolution of the USSR. And this topic, I bring this back so far that it's one of the pillars of what I do. And just like the Orange Revolution in 2004 was shocking, the one in 2014 was far more shocking. The revolution since the Zelensky nonsense. And of course, the war and the rearmament of Ukraine is the third. And it gets more extreme and more dislocating as time goes on. And that's why and Ukraine became a central concern for me after 2004. And what's happened there has been, really since the 90s, but it began in earnest in 2004, a complete decline of the political culture. Of course, the economy had already been hollowed out. You know, of course, 2004 and 2014, these protests were organized by the West, organized by U.S. intelligence. And it's fairly easy to prove it, because allegedly this was about joining the European Union, and yet no one risked their life for the EU. And back then I said, you know, I had a, you know, the Johnson's Law still exists. And one of the other ways to put it is that media have far more freedom in describing a culture like the Ukrainian, or a political culture like the Ukrainian, because of the lack of public knowledge. But even those who, you know, dabble in this kind of thing knows what happened in the early to mid 1990s. The total dissolution of the economy, the invasion of Germany in 1941 was about half the destructive consequence as what happened from 1992 to 1997. But that this awareness now, you know, Western austerity shock treatment caused the increasing depopulation of the country, that somehow that no longer is in the public consciousness is absurd. And this is one of the reasons that the regime had to completely take over all media and all education over the last few years. What had started off in 2004 as a slow accumulation of policies over the last few years has just been you know, exponentially increased. But pro-Western, in the sense of, you know, liberal capitalism, explicit movements and parties that put out these goals, they don't get more than 5 to 7%. It's the same thing in Russia. Same thing goes for some of these crazy, very strange so-called nationalist organizations that are a part of supporting a purely Judaic and internationalist government. The West continues to be associated with amoral politics, irrational economics, and naked oligarchy. But whether you are a supporter of Bandera or a Russian nationalist, there is no illusion here. The West is treated the same way. The West is atomized, alienated. It's a laboratory of psychological pathology. And therefore, nationalists anywhere reject it. Protesters in Ukraine over the years have been bussed in from elsewhere. It doesn't make any sense. And it can't be argued that a group like the OUN or any nationalist group will jettison their entire agenda to lose their independence within something like NATO or the European Union. But of course, most people don't know that. So they could say as they please. The single event since World War II in Ukraine has been, of course, the Declaration of Independence from the Soviet Union and the meltdown from 1991 to 1995. Now, Hitler's invasion of the USSR destroyed about 40% of the Russo-Ukrainian economy. But this more recent wealth transfer from Ukraine to Washington liquidated, as I said, about 80% in all sectors. So you can't talk about Ukraine without this absolute cataclysm. Now, there's a theory of international relations which I haven't brought up in a long time, the dominant theory, actually, and that's realism. It's actually a very simple, a very easy doctrine to comprehend, but it's loaded with problems. it simply says that states are united singular entities that seek their own self-interest in a global climate of essential anarchy, and that states are fairly equal. And it's kind of, you know, the neocon view of states, of governments, it doesn't have a whole lot of grounding in reality. So self-interest in this case is usually defined as a search for security. But security is a zero-sum game. It always comes at the expense of your neighbors or rivals. But it has the advantage of being very simple. But it has far more drawbacks than it does benefits. It is kind of a way that you could introduce yourself to how governments behave in the international arena in the absence of an overarching world government. But of course, now we know that the banking elite, the regime as a whole, functions as a global governing structure. Sometimes, but not always, with the American military behind it. Now, the way that a realist, I think, would approach the topic here is to argue very simply that the USSR in the late 80s could no longer defend itself. Economic dissolution, ethnic separatism, just absolutely ossified leadership, the Chernobyl story, the lost war in Afghanistan, threat from the U.S. under Reagan, forced the Soviets to loosen its control over its subject states. I'm talking about, you know, Ukraine, Lithuania, Georgia, etc. And for them at the time, there was more security to be found in independence than in remaining a part of a dying empire. So, simple cost-benefit. You could say that in Ukraine, the Declaration of Independence after a referendum in 1992 was simply a rational exercise, because even the Donbass voted to jump that sinking ship. Little did they know how bad it was going to become. But the realist point of view, I mean, this has nothing to do with metaphysics, there are many problems with it. In declaring independence in 92, there was still the question of energy. Most of the infrastructure, energy and otherwise, came from the USSR, came from the center. It's hard for cost-benefit dependence harmed the benefit side of the equation. So a westernized government in Ukraine would have to plug into other sources of supply and finance, which, without a functional economy, they could only do by using their own soldiers and their bodies as collateral. And that's ultimately what's happened in the last 10 years. But given the fact that a impoverished Ukrainian state, and the economy dissolved in a short period of time, of course, they couldn't maintain the old stock of nuclear weapons. And most of the nuclear plants there were of Russian origin, of Russian construction, and were dependent on Russian inputs, too. But as far as realism is concerned, when Ukraine gave its nuclear weapons back, it did not have the capacity to, highly, very expensive to maintain them. It gave the edge to Russia in military power. And one of the most important things, and a financial thing, is that Ukraine couldn't afford to pay in the 90s or today the old Soviet pension, the pension system, salaries to the high-tech sector. So then you had high-achieving groups coming out against this new independence fantasy, not to mention large minorities of Russian speakers in the eastern part of the country. And that served, as we well know today, as a major break on any real consolidation of state independence. So this is why, considering a state as a unitary entity, when you say things like Ukraine does X or Russia does Y, it radically oversimplifies things. And that security is so vaguely defined in this approach that it becomes worthless. But that's how, you know, I think most people continue to understand the global political and financial system. The Ukrainian state was never viable. It could not fill the gap left by the old Soviet economy. Too many powerful groups, especially in the East, who would not be a part of this integral Ukraine. And as time went on, it simply became more Western financed. Many, many times I've quoted Motel. His first name is Alexander. And he says this, and this is, you know, I've quoted him many times. He was one of the first big writers in Ukrainian politics after the collapse of the USSR. He says, quote, "The post-totalitarian imperative, however, is for post-Soviet and Western elites to realize that the successor states have virtually nothing to work with, and that while transforming what exists into something that might be possible, but doing it all at once is not." So concerning realism as a political theory, he says, there are homelands, particular nations, which can serve as ready-made vehicles of consensus, civil society, and political stability. And that is, and that was his quote, and I'm saying this is what Ukraine doesn't have. The heartland of Ukraine is undeveloped, in the western and southern parts of the country. And in the urban areas in the east, Russians and Russophiles dominate. Of course, that wasn't always the case. The Russophiles were mostly in the west, especially in Galicia and Volhynia, 100 years ago. But it was the Hungarian camps that depopulated these areas. But as I said at the time, and I continue to say, the disintegration of Ukrainian industry, which again, much of it was of Russian background, makes any attempt at independence a lost cause. The raw materials for reconstruction aren't there. Liberalism has proven itself to be more destructive than any of the attacks on Ukrainian life the past 1,000 years. The fact that they attempted to create a bilingual Ukraine militates against any kind of integral nationhood. It's two nations. You can't have an integral society with two nations in it. But the ability of Russia to absorb and transform cultural elements into a usable, workable synthesis does permit the growth of people like Shevchenko and Franco and to integrate them within sort of the same mentality as Russian Slavophiles. And they share quite a bit with the Russian Slavophiles, Shevchenko and Franco being the two biggest names in Ukrainian national literature. But even the European Union was no better. It had long since been bankrupt. A shrinking population, a total lack of identity, degenerating work ethic, and of course, immigration. Third world immigrants imported by the corporate elites to work for extremely low wages and to act as a badly behaved check on any kind of white protest has strained what was already a struggling EU economy. And then 2020 came around, and then 2022 came around. But even if somehow that could all be overcome, the conditions inherent in EU or NATO membership are anything but in Ukraine's capacity. And as I've said, they've bent the rules. In fact, they've abandoned the rules many times in the past. The fact that Albania is a NATO member makes me laugh. They really don't have an army. I guess that's the same for Iceland, but Albania is a fourth world country. They have not a single prerequisite for any kind of NATO membership, and yet they were brought into this silly alliance. But even if that were true, even if Ukraine was able to enter into these institutions, Ukrainian political, geopolitical, and economic systems will be remade. Revolutionized from Brussels and Washington. Whatever attempts in that direction that have occurred have now all been destroyed. And this is why hearing Ukrainian nationalists being a part of this was nonsensical. They totally lack principle, they totally lack direction, bankrupt in every way, or it's just not true. And to try to associate the present government there with, Shevchenko or or Donstov, any of these other people, is ridiculous. Bandera would condemn this government far more than it would the Russian. And yet, this is what the Washington Post had been preaching for a long time. Something else I said many years ago, and continues to be the case, is that Ukraine has nothing to offer the European Union. Now, there was a time a few years ago, and this still may bear fruit, but, you know, Germany was making its separate peace with the Russian Federation. It was building a partnership, and you know, if you've been listening to me for years, you know the argument. And the fact that Germany is now being deindustrialized for the sake of fighting Russia on the battlefield is something that no one could really have predicted. That the German government is, and the media is so tightly controlled that even in destroying its own economy and its own population, will continue to function and continue to have legitimacy. So actual nationalists in Ukraine fighting for Ukrainian independence have far more in common with Russian monarchists than anything that the West ever has to offer. And it's something relative to this war that I've said a million times. In the customs union, which caused the violence in 2014, or so we're told, within a Russian-led bloc, Ukraine becomes, yet again, an essential part of Eurasia. But that's not the case with the West. For Ukraine to become an essential part of Eurasia is to become a part of this continued rise of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Turkey, you know, declaring for with the East. And for a long time, up until recently, Germany rejecting the EU structures, seeking its own national interests and bilateral treaties, well, this war served the purpose of reining that in, at least for now. Yes, they are willing to go bankrupt rather than say no to the U.S., although that might be changing. I interpreted the violence of 2004 and 2014, the heavy Western involvement in Ukrainian politics at the time, as an answer to German overtures towards Russia. And the war, of course, has, among other things, the effect of eliminating that, at least for now. There's a dissident writer in Ukraine. He died in 1999, Vyacheslav Chornovil, a very responsible nationalist relative to Ukraine and in the postmodern world. Realism did appeal to him, only in the sense that an independent Ukraine, like any independent country, especially a small one, requires a fairly strong state. Ukraine's vulnerabilities in state-led economy years ago demanded a strong state. And without a strong state, you can't fight corruption or anything else. Now, of course, that ship has sailed. Corruption is the Ukrainian government. There's no healthy part of it that you can use against the unhealthy parts. Corruption is normal. But the Ukrainian national idea, in my book Ukrainian Nationalism, goes into this in painful detail. And people like Shevchenko and Franco and, you know, the Ukrainian philosophical tradition says that there are no rights outside of the ethnic collective. There are no duties outside of the ethnic collective. In fact, rights and duties, two sides of the same coin, derive from the ethnic collective. Rights have to be about something in Chernobyl's thinking. They have to have a goal. They're not just a license that permits arbitrary behavior. The ethnic collective is made up of strong local government, although unfortunately corruption shows itself in the most obnoxious way in the local level. But the other aspect about a strong state in Chernobyl's thinking is the minimization of factions. If a poverty-stricken country is going to rebuild, and that's not just Ukraine, you know, Afghanistan is the same way, Iraq, a strong sense of national unity under a strong state is absolutely necessary. It's not an option. So between 2014 and today, not only has that not occurred, but Ukraine has gone from a highly educated, the industrial hub of the USSR, to a fourth world country, with no identity or mission except the one that the West gives it. Now, Chornovil's theory, again, he was anti-Soviet. He was a dissident for a long time. And Ukrainian nationalism came into its own, over the centuries, especially in the battle against the USSR. And his theory was that the core ideas of a nation, what makes a nation really can't be destroyed. You can damage it severely, but that's the essential thing. When a country changes, it still has to be that country. Well, what makes it that country is the essence, the ethnic core. Don't forget, this isn't the first time that Ukraine has been depopulated. From Peter the Great's revenge against Mazepa, everything from World War II to the 1930s, and the demographic disaster since 1992, Ukraine has been capable of recovering from these threats. Something else when approaching this stuff is that nationalism is based on virtue. No one is going to sacrifice themselves for abstractions. No one sacrifices themselves for abstract democracy or rational choice. The Ukrainian tradition, as Tournaville lays out, no virtues can develop at all when there are no clear collective ends to be pursued. Now, in times of crisis, and from 1992 to today, Ukraine is one long fight-or-flight mode. Intense stress, intense crisis, which has to have a tremendous shaping. It has to be able to tremendously shape their psychology. But in a crisis, the main virtue is courage. I think some of you have seen this ridiculous so-called offensive that the regime, which is, you know, largely just a PR press release. Whatever Ukraine had in tanks is long gone. And Russia has just destroyed them with ease. You don't have the crews or the spare parts or anything else. Either that's desperation, that's depression, that's simply ignorance of the soldiers are simply not being told what's going on because they're simply being slaughtered. This is not the same thing as courage, though. I think maybe when the war is over, we'll get a more detailed view of what happened to the average infantryman in terms of getting them motivated. But regardless, the concept of independence is very important. It's the central concept for nationalism, and it has to be connected with self-determination. Self-determination never seems to apply to people. It only seems to apply to the state. Now, self-determination for a person implies discipline, moral, social sacrifice, the ability to reject one's own petty interest for the sake of broader social goals. But without a cohesive society, there are no social goals. The other theory that I dealt with and continue to do so is that of dependency. I tend to be more sympathetic to dependency theory than realism. Realism is not, I just don't take it seriously anymore. It's simply a thought experiment for the sake of being able to speak clearly, essentially an abbreviation of far more complicated realities. The relationship between Ukraine and Russia on the one side, Ukraine and the West on the other, either way, it's dependency. The same problem came up with Irish independence in the early 20th century. And this is what people like Imo de Valera tried to avoid. Putting up tariffs against British goods, what's the point of political independence if we're economically dependent on that market? Now, dependency bases itself around a core and a periphery. The core, of course, would be London, New York, Paris, etc. The periphery is anything from, you know, Greece to the Middle East and to the third world in general, and the poorer countries in Europe, maybe Ireland included. And dependency theory is essentially a mechanism where resources are taken from the poorer dependent areas of the world to and make the rich richer. Now, Ukraine was a part of the Soviet periphery, and dependency still matters, but don't forget, it was extremely important. One of the reasons that Ukraine is so significant to the regime is that, as you know, many have said, Russia's not an empire without it. They're Eastern Slavic Orthodox people. They belong together. It's taken a lot of time to eliminate that. And it hasn't been eliminated. The first concept, though, was the USSR was dependent on Ukraine. It wasn't just the other way around. Iron and steel, literate scientific elites, you know, the elite tech groups in the USSR were overrepresented with Ukrainians. 40% of Russian grain during the Soviet era was grown there. There is a certain dependence in the other direction. In the concept of the Ukrainian mentality means Ukrainian economy for the Ukrainian people would automatically lead to prosperity, given the advantages of the Ukrainian economy itself, but that didn't work out. But the other way you can consider dependency here is Ukraine's recent past. People forget that the Soviet economy was an integral unity. Every piece of it essentially was one big machine, and Ukraine was a big piece within that machine. It was a central part, but just one part of the integrity of the entire Soviet system. So the Ukrainian economy was built, so to speak, as a dependent entity on the USSR as a union. Independence in the early 90s didn't make a whole lot of sense. Roman Spurluk, who was a better nationalist than Moto or Tournaville ever were, he says, quote, "It's obvious that today's Ukraine cannot be considered merely a part of Soviet space. Ukraine is not only linked to Russia, but also to countries of Central Europe in the Black Sea region." Now, the argument, of course, is that independence here made perfect sense from both a geographic and an economic point of view, since Ukraine did have, let's say, unlike Ireland a century ago, Ukraine had far more weapons and resources to break this dependency. So you could say ties with Central Europe, the use of the Black Sea coast, but you had Russian minorities in the East and generally a pro-Russian point of view, especially in the older generation. Whatever weapons that Ukraine had failed to be properly used because of the extreme distortions introduced by the Judaic oligarchy and its sponsorship by the West. Anytime the oligarchs take over 2004, 2014, today, and they've ruled the country almost uninterrupted, they dissolve what's left of the economy and use it to pay debt, use it to buy their way into the Western world. But it's not crazy to say that the Soviet Empire was based on the idea of mutual dependence. Again, one of the reasons why Ukraine is so important to Moscow. But let me summarize what I've been talking about here. Dependency theory makes a lot of sense when you're talking about Ukraine, because one of the central concepts is that of distortion. If an economy is fashioned by an imperial center, you know, all the dependent states of the former USSR, Moscow in this case, for the interest not just of Ukraine, but for the entire Union, the economy is already distorted. You know, built over 70 years, at least most of it, to serve something other than the Ukrainian population as a unit. And this concept dominated Ukrainian politics from World War II on. The other concept of dependency important here is the creation of an elite class. An elite class today, which is totally controlled by the West, and in decades ago, an elite created by the Communist Party. It's not a national entity. What it meant to be politically rational, or I should say politically active in Ukraine, was to be a member of the party. And that party, recruited, trained, and supervised by the Soviet Union as a whole, hence was cosmopolitan in scope, it was a-national, and would form an anti-independence group in the early 90s. Either way, you have a dependent and political class, and in fact, the political class is created by either the East or the West, at least during the Soviet era, the West today. Oligarchy, as you know, I've been deep into understanding the economic consequences of oligarchy. That, as again, it's a huge break on actual development. Their professional and financial interests are served by supporting the empire, supporting the West, and their rule will always inhibit an actual national economy. So 40 years ago, those ruling Ukraine were serving the Soviet Union. Today, they serve, there were actually quite a different group of people serving Western finance capital. And finally, the concept of dependency says that the nature of economic growth in a system like this means that important, maybe even critical areas of the economy will be chronically underdeveloped. Since, especially in the old Soviet sense, all other areas important to national growth were being dealt with elsewhere in the empire. So Ukraine could then specialize. You can't be a specialist country when you become independent, especially if you're a nationalist. So upon the Declaration of Independence in 1992, you had key critical areas of economic development that were underfunded or even non-existent. And in many ways, that, you know, the things like the banking sector, public health, all that. But in 2004, the oligarchy who had long since been in power, although people like Kuchma and Yushchenko were able to say no to them on occasion, as a way to avoid the Russian state, they realized that they had a sponsor in the U.S. and in Brussels. Another dissident worth talking about, Ivan Zyuba. He was one of the great dissidents from the 1960s, as was Tournaville. And these were all nationalists of one form or another. And Zyuba was somebody who wanted to build something specifically Ukrainian. There's nothing in the free market that's Ukrainian. There's nothing in the realist concept of the unitary state that's Ukrainian. But at an absolute minimum, people like Zyuba were interested in creating a nationalism that protects the economy from the manipulation, speculation, and uncertainty of international financial forces over which nations have zero control. And in this case, remember, an empire is the polar opposite of a nation. No imperial entity can be simultaneously ethno-nationalist. But Zyuba eventually went over to the side of European integration. And the only excuse he may have for that is, you know, he was raised and fought against the USSR. Back then, those in the Soviet Union got either a very good or a very bad perception of the Western world. If he were writing today, of course, it would be a different story. The West is dying. It can't pay its debts. It's been invaded. The crime is out of control. Its native stock is not reproducing. It's in a state of constant war. No one trusts the elites or the financial oligarchy. The only cohesive ruling class in any of the major Western states is oligarchs. The oligarchs. There's nothing to be gained and much to lose, though, by trading one form of dependency for another. Dependency, of course, is the enemy of anything nationalist. If dependence on the will of others is evil for a person, then it's equally evil for a whole society. Dependency, given the sheer volume of power wielded by just a few banks, that's not something that's easy to deal with. Now, Zyuba argues that there's a few things that are needed to make independence something other than a word. And the first thing is the resurrection of the old folk traditions, and hence the revitalization of rural areas. Whether it be the USSR or Western liberalism, those traditions have been under attack. They've been artificially destroyed systematically. They need to be rehabilitated, as does the village. The second is integrity. In other words, the integration, the symbiosis of different functional groups, regions, and mentalities with the purpose of creating a functional organism. So symbiosis suggests that society is an integrated whole. It differs in function and regional specialization, but it's still a whole. Not only is that consistent with nationalism, it's required by it. Only the capitalist state, the socialist state, sees itself as absolute. And if you see yourself as absolute, and it doesn't matter, you have the same amount of power, whether you're an oligarch or a party member, and they're very similar. When you see yourself as absolute, the population then appears and should be a bunch of simple disembodied egos. The third thing is national unity, it really doesn't matter where you are, is achieved by having a social life integrated with your own history. Its philosophical implications, its native theology. Ukraine became what it is as an Orthodox nation fighting Polish Catholicism. And after that, the 18th century in Russia, Peter and Catherine the Great, their secularizing contempt of the church, and of course later Soviet persecution, and today a violent imperial liberalism, which has killed far more Ukrainians than Stalin ever did. And that's, it's getting worse, not better. Ukraine has an ethnic identity that was born in religious battles, connected to Orthodoxy, and therefore Orthodoxy offers the goals of any independent society. Now, if the cosmopolitan emptiness of global capitalism was ever to be real, ever to be realized 100%, and this is Yuba talking, it would be the death not only of independence, but of all thought. The only idea that would be left would be this nominalist positivist ideology, which then, because of its destruction of everything else, there'd be no way to critique it. There'd be no place to stand. It would ultimately come down to ego gratification. Ego gratification within this visual corporate matrix. It is not human, it is not life, and it certainly is not thought. Now, Alexander Dugin does have an interest here in terms of what dependency is, because he argues that Russia, along with Brazil, India, China, make up a kind of semi-periphery in the dependent system. The concept that many people have argued is that economic forces make international history, and economics, the drive for usury, is fetishized into ideologies that serve the interests of one metropolitan center or another one. And Dugin actually does talk about dependency in his theory of a multipolar world. And he summarizes it very well. And there's really not a whole lot of people, scholars in the U.S. who want to apply dependency in this situation. It no longer serves their interests. And it's really reducible to the idea that the political class that gets promoted is the one who has economic power. Profits accrue to private actors, not the state, while politicians are used to take blame for failures. So let me quote him here. This is from 2012. We're talking about relative to Russia now. Russia's sovereignty depends on the ability of Central Europe to achieve freedom in the face of U.S. and China, to maintain and fortify its influence in the Pacific. In turn, Europe and China, as well as all other possible civilizations, become even more dependent on Russia's ability to indicate the demands of global rule and to create a coalition of Eurasian continental alliances. Therefore, the strategic project of defending its own social independence makes Russia unique. She will assist in the building of this reality elsewhere, regardless of the distance. There's another concept which is very important, and I've mentioned it many times, constructivism. It's one of the essential aspects. It's more of a psychological approach than something that's just strictly in the realm of the political. It concerns how a ruling element, the regime in the West, constructs itself, the story it tells, the mythology that it tells itself to justify its rule. It constructs it. But it also projects and constructs its enemy. This is why the public ignorance, even among elites, concerning things of Eastern Europe is not important. The enemy has been constructed. It's been invented. It doesn't have to be analyzed because, whether it's real or not is unimportant. And that's why these people sound ridiculous, talking about Ukraine winning the war or something like that. It's a projection of their own neuroses rather than an actual analysis of what exists. Their own rule as an oligarchy, the regime in the West, as well as their opponents, including people like me, they're constructed from materials coming from their own very eccentric view of history or whatever. Perception is far more real than reality. And this is a very postmodern concept. You know, reality tends to win over time, but the only thing that seems to matter isn't so much the reality, but its interpretation, or even worse, its invention. You know, the initial Russian mind was in Kiev. The Tartar occupation changed all this, and it altered, and it pushed Russia from a Central European to a Eurasian power. A huge part, people like Yuri Lipa, a huge part of the Ukrainian nationalist movement sees itself not as Western, but as Central. But as Russian power moved east, the end of the Middle Ages, Kiev itself became a fringe, part of the Western fringe of Russia. Most, for the most part, under the rule of Poland, Austria, and at their best, the Cossack state, as we've talked about a few weeks ago. But those entities were only indirect in their influence on Moscow. Moscow went even beyond an ethnicity in a nation and became a civilization. This is one of the things that makes this whole St. Petersburg experiment such a such blasphemy. It didn't matter, though. The core remained Eurasian. And once the Soviets weakened, that mentality came back. Weaker, but it came back. Ukraine, on the other hand, is influenced by Poland and Central Europe, is a nation, not a civilization. Russia today is a civilization. So understanding Kiev as a nation rather than a civilization is a key point to make when approaching anything concerning the situation here. So the Russian understanding of reality is based on the concept of the Russian nation, the Russian space, which does include much of Ukraine. I mean, there are, you know, they are for the most part a common language, kind of like Spanish and Portuguese, I would say. They're very similar approaches to political science, same religion, of course, and the long-term relations between the two states, whether it be the Tsarism and the Soviet Union, have created a sense of common life, and that can't be ignored. Now, but, you know, they don't make up the invention. Those are just the material conditions for theory to start from. But constructivism can be very dangerous. Its only benefit is that it deals primarily with the creation of consensus. But the consensus has to be based on something real, not something that you're told. It can't be based on images. So if it comes from ethnic historical fundamentals of a nation in building its basic constitution, that's a different story. Foreign and domestic issues really aren't all that distinct. But it could also cover the manipulated artificial consensus of the regime. And there's someone else who I've admired in the history of Ukrainian thought in recent years, Oleksandr Moroz. He put out over the years, he's a social nationalist. He has a, you know, coherent and defensible understanding of what this mutual construction might be. But when you have no social unity, constructions have to be imposed by force. These state forms, especially in Ukraine, remain fluid and changing. There's nothing to construct from. Any stereotype is going to be false. But only liberalism can come up with something like this. So, but since 1989, people like Moroz refuse to allow images to distort or to change what reality is. An oligarchy has ruled Ukraine since the late 80s. They're mostly Judaic, and they despise the average Ukrainian. They manipulated the privatization of state industries in their own interests, and the West, that is the financial and academic elites, supported the process. Facts matter, but the interpretation matters as much, at least. The association between Ukraine and Russia matters, but for Russia, it's the proof of identity. But for Ukraine, it's the proof of empire. And I take a middle ground, the same ground that Gogol did in his own unfinished work on Ukrainian history. And Gogol made two simple points Of course, he never had a chance to develop it. But the first one is that Russia and Ukraine developed differently due to different political environments. But also, their similarities can't be ignored. So Ukrainian autonomy is an ethical imperative, but one that ends up being close to Russia. But, you know, Drahomanov, Kulish, Kotlyarsky, Gogol himself promoted a concept of Ukrainian mission without excluding Russia and Belarus. Now let me summarize someone like Morozh. And this isn't coming from my Ukraine book, but it is certainly dealt with in there. But what was created in Ukraine starting in the early 90s, the result of privatization, he describes as a sort of semi-industrial feudalism. Liberalism is the rule of capital, the manipulation, the creation of markets rather than responding to markets. It's an imperial ideology, and its practical economic goals is the eternal search for cheap labor to exploit and raw materials to plunder. He points out, a point I often forget, that in the early 90s, the Judaic oligarchs rejected the concept of single-member voting districts. You know, winner-take-all, like, you know, the way that American congressional districts are organized. That's because a system like the American has a geographical focus. You have a congressional district that has boundaries, and there's an election just in those boundaries for a member of Congress, and whoever gets the most votes is brought into office. That was rejected early on by the oligarchy in Ukraine, because capitalism and financial speculation doesn't have a geographical focus. And that's, you know, land was seen as a commodity, since it's the primary asset of farmers in the agricultural sector. But as you know, as I've been saying for a long time, it's become a collateral for loans and a vehicle for total dependency, fallen into the hands of speculators. The other thing that Morozh says is that private property is a mystification. And mystification and constructivism are very similar. Capital has to rule through images. It has to rule through slogans, prima facie, simplistic ideologies. Politicians are the public face of that kind of industrial clan. Morozh is one of the first people that I ever came across that argued that capitalism is not a matter of competition, but the concept of private property. Because competition is eliminated through financial consolidation, and capital solely becomes the property of a handful. The pseudo-national and pseudo-nationalist agitation against Russia is as fake as you can get. And it's designed so as to blame Russia for all the problems of Ukraine. It's a false nationalism because it sees the EU somehow as a future of the country, which will cancel Ukrainian independence with more vehemence than Marxism did. Many polls, especially both in Ukrainian and Russian, show the majority of Ukrainians prior to 2014 having a very positive view both of Eurasian integration and Russia in general. The agitation against Russia is also a mystification. The West has created these stereotypes. But the educated population that used to be important in Ukraine, as well as its natural resources and very strategic location, they're essential to dependency. The continued elite control in the West. A country can't be, you know, dependency is essentially a form of colonial rule. What Morozh advocates is a central European identity with the revitalization of the village, state-directed investment, and at least in many strategic areas, labor corporations that could negotiate with firms on an equal footing, the creation of a domestic market rather than an international market, and a market-based society with substantial regulation and social insurance. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with that. This is essentially the nationalist economic program. Morozh, back in 2013, wrote his open letter to Yanukovych. That was the president who was driven out in 2014. He says that Ukraine, this period of time, is experiencing another ruin. A ruin is a term used in Ukrainian history to describe what happened to the country after the death of Kim Il-nitsky, after the 1648 revolution. The Cossack ruling class split. They were easily manipulated. They lost a few battles. Foreign occupation, including trying to use the Turks as mercenaries under Doroshenko. That was the ruin. To say that Ukraine is in another ruin is really to understate the case. Elections are a farce then and now. Especially then, because political parties in Ukraine had nothing to do with politics. They simply represented a personal interest. He also wrote an excellent letter called Folk Orthodoxy, a Ukrainian Orthodox tradition bound to the locality. Strong, supporting the weak, as a church preaches. Labor to receive the due value of its work and to have a substantial say over corporate policy. But the way that the regime created the Ukrainian political system years ago was created for oligarchic rule. Initially, the president and the prime minister were supposed to check each other. The initial concept was in checking each other, the oligarchs can rule freely, and that's exactly what happened. Over the years, the president became more and more powerful, but that could only happen when the regime was confident that they'll be able to control elections, or at least create riots whenever it suited them to get rid of somebody who shouldn't be in the presidential office. Now, as of now, you know, from 2014 to today, the East-West distinction is very much overdrawn. Now, given the war and the population transfers in the East, that might have changed. But, you know, there is a broader conception of Ukrainian that's not based on East-West dichotomies. There will be a time where, you know, Ukraine returns to some variation of normal. But in Ukrainian history, you know, for many years, describing yourself as Russian didn't necessarily refer even to ethnicity or language. In a very bad sense, it meant that you were from the upper class, urban, and educated. In the East, Ukraine was depopulated, and they settled Red Army veterans there after World War II. Eastern Ukraine, up until the war, had a substantial nationalist population, just like Eastern Ukraine had a strong nationalist one, but not the sort of nationalism that, you know, the regime is promoting. My favorite party, and of course they've been banned and taken, was Natalie Vatrenko's Progressive Socialist Party of Ukraine. They based themselves in the concept of dependency, looking to Russia and the Eurasian Union to save it from the moribund EU, pointing out that as of a few years ago, 50% of all of their foreign trade went to the CIS, and only about 20% went to the EU. And what kind of trade? The EU trade was mostly primary products, while trade with the CIS was high-value added goods. So what it came down to was that independence meant looting of Ukraine. The crisis, the Ukrainian economy, which started in the early 90s, but for our purposes began in 2007, was the creation of speculation and usury. In 2014, 80% of Ukrainians lived below the poverty line. At this same time, you had a full 20% of the Ukrainian population wanted immediate reunification with Russia. But 81%, there's some overlap here, wanted to be a part of a very strong Eurasian customs union. And the number prior to the war, or I should say prior to 2014, you had about a 65-70% support for a Eurasian union in Western Ukraine. But when you don't know anything about the country or its tradition or what motivates whom in what way, you could fall for these slogans of East-West Ukraine. People forget that Galicia was the hotbed of Russophilism 100 years ago. People like P.N. Simonenko, who was a national communist, national socialist, who argued that that the turn to the West in Ukrainian history, not just now, but in the past, has consistently been a disaster. As I've been saying for two decades, Ukraine doesn't offer much to the West, but it does offer a lot to the East. For years, I spoke of Ukraine as this tremendous, this potentially globally powerful entity. But when the IMF took over, and that was, you know, the IMF being the imperial entity that supported the oligarchs as their dependent class there, needed to make sure that the country supports the IMF, they insisted, like treating it like a third world country, that Ukraine should be promoting the trade of primary exports, which means finished products cost more than primary exports, so the country's always in debt. The IMF was a part of the complete meltdown of the Ukrainian economy. Oligarchy is the enemy of mankind, as Semenenko would say. And really, in his mind, any allies are accepted against them. That the speculators and usurers of Ukraine are not part of the nation, they're usually not Ukrainian, and Semenenko was not shy about that. They want short-term profit because they have no long-term trust in Ukraine or the West as a whole. Production is based on credit and therefore can't last, and that's the nature of the crisis. But Rutschenko, Semenenko, made a name for themselves by saying that capitalism is oligarchy, and that's why their parties have long since been banned and their assets confiscated. Anyway, we're at an hour now. I hope this program has given some conception of how to begin thinking about this situation. That facts have to be put into one of these theoretical systems in order to make sense out of it, but that ultimately dependency is the most accurate one. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I will talk to you next time. Bye-bye.